Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Scott Wiedensahl, writer, researcher, specializing in birds and bird migration. And we're talking about his new book, A World on the Wing, The Global Odyssey of Migratory Birds. Scott, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
I said this to you before off mic, but you know, I read a lot of books on migration. I'm passionate about migration, of course. And I thought, well, this will be another good one because he's an excellent writer. But you outdid yourself on this book. This has two sort of parallel tracks that interweave. One is sort of boots on the ground reporting from various points in the world, which are stopover points for migrants. And that we'll get into that a little bit later. And the second one has to be summed up as everything you think you knew is wrong, <It's> like, which is from the Fireside Theater. But it's essentially that whatever you thought you knew about migration, there's a lot more that we now know. And that was absolutely fascinating. You uncovered all the information, were you blown away too?
Well, because that's the thing about migration. That's the thing about science. You know, as my mother, and I observed this in the
yep.
book, as my
oh,
mother
yeah.
once said to me, you know, she said, you know, the thing that bothers me about scientists, they always say, we used to think, but now we know. And of course, science is a process. So we really ought to be saying, we used to think, but now we think, but you know, as new information comes along, it'll change our understanding. But every time we think we understand what birds are capable of, especially like in the physiological realm,
oh man,
the physical extent of migration, every time we think we figure out what the limits are, the birds just kind of blow right past them.
And part of the reason we're able to know that has been an electronics revolution that's occurred in the last decade and a half.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this revolution in miniaturization that's allowing us to track even the smallest migrants, in many cases, on almost a second-by-second basis. And this is something that I've been personally very involved in over the last 15 or 20 years, you know, using GPS, GSM transmitters to follow snowy owls in the wintertime, you know, like literally recording locations every 6 seconds. And the new MODIS wildlife tracking system
yeah.
is allowing us to track not just small birds like warblers and hummingbirds, but actually, you know, migratory insects like dragonflies and monarch butterflies, migratory bats.
And
it's amazing stuff.
It's not just where they are. There's other kinds of electronics that are measuring other things that are happening to the birds in migration, and that's incredible.
Well, yeah. I mean, for example, you know, just to prove that we consistently underestimate what birds are able to do, in 2013, scientists in Switzerland were interested in understanding where alpine swifts
in
Switzerland in the summertime go in the winter. They knew they went to Africa, but they wanted to find out specifically where they went. So they put these little data loggers on the birds with a geolocator that would record the bird's location. And when the bird came back the next spring, they'd be able to download that information. But they also put tiny little accelerometers in these data loggers so they could tell how much of the bird's day was spent sleeping, how much of the bird's day was spent in flight. Because they had that information for the breeding grounds. They wanted it for migration in winter. And they let the birds go. They come back the next year. They download the data. And the accelerometer just kind of flatlined at constant activity for 200 days without pause. These birds don't stop flying the entire time they're in migration and on the wintering grounds, which is amazing enough. But then they, you know, scientists in Sweden replicated that experiment with common swifts and discovered that they spend 10 months in continuous flight, continuous powered flight, I might add. They're not soaring. You know, these are not birds that drift languidly on the wing for 10 months when they're migrating in Africa. You know, they eat on the wing, they sleep on the wing. Every time we think we understand where the limits are, the birds kind of laugh at us and just keep going.
Everything's been extended. I mean, I remember the distances quotes that everybody used to give in lectures about how far Arctic terns flew in migration. All those numbers have been exploded.
Yeah. Yeah. I wrote a previous book on bird migration
yeah.
called Living on the Wind that came out in 1999. And at the time, you know, Arctic terns are the size of mourning doves. They were way too small to put any kind of tracking device on. So the best you could do was say, okay, well, they breed in the highest latitudes in the Northern Hemisphere. We know they winter in the Southern Ocean. You draw some lines on the map and it's 22,000 to 25,000 miles a year, which is impressive. You know, that's not a small number. And yet now that we've got light sensitive geolocators, my good friend and colleague, Dr. Ian Stenhouse at the Biodiversity Research Institute in Maine, was part of the team that put geolocators on Arctic terns in Greenland and Iceland and discovered they were flying 47,000 miles a year. And then another scientist did that on birds nesting in Denmark, and they're going 51,000 miles a year. And turns out the Arctic terns that breed on the coast of Maine are flying up to 57,000 miles a year. They're going from Maine to the Indian Ocean to spend the winter. I mean, some of these birds are circumnavigating Antarctica in the austral summer. It's just amazing. And we don't really know, you know, Arctic terns winter as well in the Pacific Ocean, and we don't have a really good idea what those birds are doing. And the Pacific, I will note, is a very much larger ocean than the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean. So who knows what the real limits of Arctic tern migration are?
It's the physiological, down to the cellular level, changes that people have discovered that these birds in migration are accomplishing. I mean, to fly this far for this long, they've discovered things like bar-tailed godwits migrating between Western Africa and the Netherlands, 2,700 miles, which sounds like a small amount compared to the distances we've been calling. They've started to measure the hydration rates of these things.
These birds,
and it's amazing what they're finding out.
Well, sure. I mean, if for a bird that is flying for, you know, days or sometimes weeks on end without stopping to rest and refuel and drink, that dehydration would be a real problem. And they've discovered that these birds are able to, essentially, they're able to drink from their organs and from their muscle tissue as they start catabolizing, you know, their muscle tissue and their organ tissue. It frees up metabolic water, because when they're burning fat's their major migratory fuel. It doesn't really produce a lot of metabolic water. So in some cases, birds like red knots in old world populations, their organs will grow dramatically during the migration season, probably as a reservoir for energy and particularly for metabolic water. They've discovered that some migrants trying to cross the Sahara Desert, coming north from Africa to heading for Europe, die from starvation as they're going across the Sahara. And yet when they test the bodies of these emaciated birds, their water balance is normal, because they were, even up until the point of death, they were able to draw on their organs and their muscles to at least keep themselves from dehydrating. Now, you know, obviously those birds died from starvation. Most of them don't do that. But, you know, but this internal shift these birds go through. I mentioned that some red knots, their organs actually grow before migration. The bar-tailed godwits that breed in western Alaska that fly 7,200 miles nonstop across the Pacific Ocean to New Zealand and Australia for the winter, which is the longest nonstop migration of any bird we know. It takes them like up to 11 days. Their guts actually shrink dramatically before they take off. They eat as much as they possibly can in Alaska. They more than double their weight, actually. They're 55% fat when they take off. And having, you know, gained as much weight as they possibly can, they no longer need their digestive system. So in a matter of days, their stomach, their intestines, their kidneys atrophy dramatically. They take off. They make this incredible flight to, down to New Zealand. They land. They regrow their guts again in a matter of just a day or two and start eating. And they spend the austral summer feeding happily on the Firth of Thames and on the North Island of New Zealand or along the coast of Australia. And then they undergo the whole same process again, fly 6,000 miles from there to the Yellow Sea between China and the Korean Peninsula, regrow their guts, eat, balloon up in weight, guts shrink down again. They fly another 5,000 miles back to Alaska, 18,000 miles a year between these three locations, Alaska, Australasia, and the Yellow Sea. And they're basically going from a sumo wrestler to the skinniest runway model you can imagine to a sumo wrestler. That's called yo-yo dieting.
Yeah.
That's dangerous for people. That will put you in the ground in a hurry. And in fact, scientists who have studied migratory birds say that the blood chemistry of a migratory bird resembles that of a morbidly obese diabetic with serious coronary disease, and yet the birds suffer no ill effects from this. So there is a lot of interest on the part of the human medical community to understanding how birds can do this and how we might be able to replicate some of this among people. For example, you know, those bar-tailed godwits, before they take off, their breast muscles increase in mass 50% without exercise. Sign me up for that pill.
Their oxygen consumption, like, there are species like bar-headed goose that fly over the Himalayas. And as many people know who know and read stories about people trying to get to the top of the Himalayas, oxygen's a real issue. How are these birds able to do this?
Yeah, I mean, imagine some poor schmuck who's spent weeks like acclimating at different base camps, climbing higher and higher up Everest, and they're up in the death zone, you know, above 25,000 feet, sucking on supplemental oxygen, just, you know, barely able to drag one foot in front of the other. And they look overhead, and whoop, there goes a flock of bar-headed geese, you know, at 30,000 feet, you know, with apparent effortlessness. So here's the thing. Any off-the-shelf bird has a dramatically more efficient respiratory system than even most elite human athlete. We breathe in and exhale in what's known as a tidal system. The air goes in and out the same way. We're woefully inadequate at withdrawing a lot of oxygen from the air we breathe. Birds have this complex of air sacs connected to its respiratory system, you know, throughout its body. And actually, every inhalation that a bird takes requires four breaths to move through the entire system of air sacs and lungs. So they're able to pull a great deal more oxygen, up to 90% of the oxygen out of the air they breathe. And bar-headed geese, which, as you say, take off from the lowlands in India and make a single nonstop flight over the Himalaya Mountains, you know, they have a much more efficient respiratory system than even most birds. They've got much more efficient hemoglobin. It's much better at pulling oxygen out of the air and transporting it through the bird's circulatory system to its cells. They're immune to pulmonary edema, which kills a lot of human hikers and climbers at high elevation. That's one of the real dangers of high altitude climbing. And we don't really know how they're able to do that. So, again, a lot of interest on the part of human physiologists in understanding how birds can accomplish the things that they do.
Now, when people hear about these days-long continual flights, they probably are asking, well, how do they sleep? And that's another interesting finding that just came out. They have unihemispheric sleep.
Yeah. They basically put half their brain to sleep at a time. And this is not like my wife saying that I'm not paying attention to her because I'm half asleep, but they're able to put, you know, one hemisphere of their brain and the corresponding eye to sleep for as little sometimes as just a few seconds at a time and just alternate back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And interestingly, the breakthrough in understanding how birds are able to do this came from studies of a non-migratory bird, the great frigate bird in the Galapagos Islands, which doesn't migrate, but it takes foraging trips away from the nest that can last up to 12 days. And because frigate birds are not waterproof, they can't land. They have to remain in the air the entire time that they're off on these long foraging trips. And so scientists put little data loggers, little dunce caps on the heads of these birds that monitor their brain waves. And because it's the Galapagos, you know, these birds are extremely approachable. So they were able to, you know, attach these to the birds on the nest. The bird goes off on a foraging expedition, comes back, and they download the data. But, you know, here's the thing, Mark. We actually kind of do the same thing. If you've ever spent a night, like, for example, in a hotel room and had a really lousy night's sleep the first night, that's called first night effect. It's common among people. And scientists in Georgia have discovered that our brains are kind of doing the same thing. Part of our brain doesn't go fully asleep the first night that we're sleeping in an unfamiliar place. It's not awake. They call it not sleep. And it's not exactly comparable to unihemispheric sleep in birds, but, you know, we're similar enough to birds in ways that I think would surprise the average person.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Scott Wiedenthal, writer and researcher specializing in birds and bird migration. And we're talking about his new book. It is a gripping read in parts, A World on the Wing, The Global Odyssey of Migratory Birds. Scott, one of the things that, and I've lectured about too, about how birds are navigating these long distances. And we won't go through all the things, but you know what I'm going to ask you? Because I've actually talked to physicists, quantum physicists, and this if there was a moment in this book that totally blows my mind, this was it. There is a real possibility that birds are utilizing quantum entanglement to navigate.
I know. It's like it's totally sci-fi, and birds have probably been doing it.
Well, that just ratcheted up everything to like the nth degree right there.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is the part of quantum physics that made Einstein uncomfortable. I mean, I said in the book, it's probably a good thing Einstein wasn't a bird because this wouldn't make him happy. So we've known since the 1850s that birds have a magnetic sense, that they're able to orient using the Earth's magnetic field. And we've known since the middle of the 20th century that it was connected somehow to vision. But figuring out how, like, for example, when I was in college in the 1970s, I took a course in ornithology, and we were taught birds had little magnetic crystals.
Yeah, magnetite, little pieces of magnetite, yeah.
Right, that it kind of functioned like a little compass, you know, pulled their nose to the north. Well, it turns out that it appears that those so-called magnetite deposits in their brain are actually part of their immune system, has nothing to do with navigation. But yes, birds are using this form of quantum physics called quantum entanglement, which is, and I am not a quantum physicist, nor do I play one on television.
The other term for it is spooky action at a distance.
Yes, that's what Einstein called it, dismissively. I mean, that was an aspect of his equations that he found deeply unsettling. So essentially what happens is when a bird is migrating through the night sky, and of course most birds migrate at night, a photon of blue light from a distant star enters the bird's eye, hits a molecule of a pigment called cryptochrome, and it knocks an electron out of that molecule and into an adjacent cryptochrome molecule. So those two particles are now linked. These electrons that's been bumped out of one and bumped into the other. Under quantum theory, if those two particles are moved anywhere in the universe, regardless of distance, what affects one will instantaneously affect the other, which is why scientists are exploring quantum entanglement to try to develop faster-than-light communication and unhackable quantum computers and possibly teleportation. But what appears to be happening in the eye of the bird is that these pigment molecules are being activated by light, you know, a millionth of a second at a time, and it appears to be creating waves of pigment in the bird's eye that allow it to visualize the Earth's magnetic field. I would love to see the Earth's magnetic field. It must be an amazing sight. Every magnolia warbler and house wren and barn swallow flying around can apparently see this, and apparently a lot of other organisms can too, because many other organisms like bumblebees and red-spotted newts can orient magnetically unless they are exposed to wavelengths of red light, in which case they lose their ability to orient magnetically. So it's very possible that this is something that is found more widely through the animal kingdom rather than just in migratory birds. But it's been studied most intensely in the last 10 years in migratory birds. The guy that came up with this idea, by the way, was a fellow named Dr. Klaus Schulten. The late Dr. Klaus Schulten, unfortunately, passed away a couple of years ago. And he first proposed this back in the 1970s. And when he submitted this idea to a prominent journal, he was told that, you know, a less bold scientist probably would just throw this in the waste can because they declined to – it was too wacky. They declined to print it initially. But, you know, Dr. Schulten lived long enough to see experimental evidence to show that his theories on quantum entanglement and the magnetic orientation of birds are probably accurate.
Now, getting to the other parallel track in your book, you visit a number of locations around the world. And it used to be that we thought, like, well, if we preserve the forest, the birds are saved. And now we're realizing the picture's not so simple at all. You start out at a classic stopover site in China. I'm probably going to mispronounce Jiangsu province or Su province, an incredible area of mudflats, which is a stopover site for one of the most charismatic shorebirds that anybody could ever want, the spoonbill sandpiper.
Yeah.
Why are these stopover sites starting to be recognized as so critical to migrants?
Well, you'd think that we'd have figured this out a little bit earlier. I mean, anybody who's taken a long road trip knows you can't go from point A to point B without stopping for gas and food and lodging somewhere along the way. But you're right. I mean, for a long time, through much of the 20th century, we focused on just protecting the breeding areas. And then we got a little bit more sophisticated, especially starting in the 1980s with the recognition that we were losing a lot of tropical forests. And, of course, many of our migrant birds winter in the neotropics. And so we started focusing a little bit more on, you know, saving the rainforest, even though migratory birds use a whole host of tropical habitats. And really only in the last 20 years or so have we begun to understand, hey, we have to save all of the points in between where these birds are stopping off that are absolutely critical. And the Yellow Sea between China and the Korean Peninsula is certainly one of the most important migratory stopover sites in the world, and without question, the most endangered. Just from a shorebird perspective, something like 11 to 13 million shorebirds from this vast East Asian, Australasian flyway, basically, wintering grounds that stretch into Oceania and Australia, New Zealand, New Guinea, up through, Borneo and the Philippines and Southeast Asia, and then birds that breed basically from, Western Eurasia all the way into Western and Central Africa and Yukon, depend on the mudflats, as you say, along the Yellow Sea.
It's an amazing stretch of mudflats, and you describe it so vividly in the book. The problem is everything seems to be against it, the survival of this. China's got incredible reclamation projects going on.
Yes. Yeah, China and South Korea have destroyed between 60 and 70% of the mudflats on the Yellow Sea. And these are enormous mudflats. When the tide goes out at Dongling on the Jiangsu coast, you mentioned north of Shanghai, it goes out like 20 or 30 kilometers. They're vast, vast mudflats. But yeah, they've been the Chinese and the South Korean government have built enormous seawalls and then pumped millions and millions of cubic meters of sediment in to create dry land for industrial sites and cities and aquaculture. These deep ponds for shrimp and jellyfish, which don't really do the shorebirds any good, and it's been devastating for shorebirds. For example, the South Koreans built a 21-mile-long seawall that walled off about 150 square miles of once vibrant mudflat, on which a fifth of the world's great knots depended. And in the wake of that, a fifth of the world's great knots disappeared. And it's not like they went somewhere else. I mean, scientists have looked for them. The population dropped by a fifth. Those birds died. In fact, it's at the point now, as one scientist told me, it's a birds per hectare equation. For every additional couple of acres of mudflat that is destroyed, birds die because they simply have no place else to go. But here's the thing. In part, as you say, because of this weirdly charismatic shorebird, the spoon-billed sandpiper, that has this funky spatulate bill. it looks like a semi-pomaded sandpiper, or in Asia, it looks like a redneck stint, which is their version of our semi-pomaded sandpiper, that somebody took a hammer and like whacked the end of its bill and flattened it out. There's only about 200 to 600 of them left on the planet. They breed in the Russian Far East. They winter in Southeast Asia. They absolutely need the Yellow Sea. And a combination of the loss of Yellow Sea mudflats and illegal hunting in Southeast Asia has brought them to the brink of extinction. But because there's been so much attention focused on the spoon-billed sandpiper and on the shorebirds as a whole that need the Yellow Sea, in 2018, a really remarkable thing happened. The Chinese government, doing what totalitarian governments can do, which is, one person makes a decision and the whole rest of the country has to jump, they decided that all future commercial reclamation activity along the Yellow Sea coast in China would cease completely and utterly and immediately. They left the door open for what they called projects of national importance, but almost all of this coastal destruction was happening at the local and county level for commercial projects, and that all just stopped. So when I was over there in the spring of 2018, just a few months after this edict came down, I found myself with Chinese conservationists like Jing Li and international scientists like Dr. Tunis Piersma from the Netherlands, who's been studying the shorebirds on the Yellow Sea for decades. And I found them grappling with a very unfamiliar emotion, which was hope.
I know.
Tunis told me, he said, I thought my job here was to document the extinction of these birds. But he said, now I hope I have enough life left to see their recovery. And, Tunis and I are about the same age, so I hope we both have enough life left to see them.
It's amazing. At every stopping point, the amount of obstacles facing these migrants seems almost insurmountable, but there's always some little sliver of hope if people are active. But also what we've learned about even the birds that breed here, the warblers, the deep forest warblers, when they're done breeding, you think that they stay in the forest, but they don't. They need another kind of habitat. They need regrowth forest.
Right. Well, and this comes back to, you know, we used to think, but well, yeah. Now we know. You know, when I back in the 1980s and particularly the 90s, when I was writing Living on the Wind, my last big book on migration, the assumption was that for forest interior species, many of these warblers, for thrushes like hermit thrushes and Swainson's thrushes and wood thrushes, for scarlet tanagers, you know, that they need big, unbroken, contiguous, unfragmented blocks of forest. And so a lot of bird conservation became focused on preserving these big unbroken blocks of forest.
And we need to do that. And we do need to do that.
We need to do that. And we need to do that. But of course, it's much more complicated than that.
Yeah.
Because what we did not realize, because it's very, very difficult to follow young birds immediately after they leave their nest, is that once these birds leave their nest and have successfully raised a brood of babies deep in these interior forests where they're fairly safe from predators, the adult birds immediately move those young birds into early successional forest, into thickets, basically.
Raspberry thickets. Like there's a lot of raspberry.
Yeah, right.
It's filled with insects.
Exactly. Filled with insects, filled with fruit. They're photosynthetic juggernauts, basically. And we didn't realize that. And so, you know, what we've been doing is preserving big blocks of forest in some places and then cutting down big blocks of forest in other places. And what we need to do, and I guess this really shouldn't surprise us if we think about it, we need to replicate the kind of structural complexity that forests, particularly in the East and upper Midwest, had in pre-settlement, pre-colonial times, where you had huge, old, mature trees with light gaps where trees have fallen, where there were small wildfires, regenerating beaver meadows, a mosaic of different age classes from very old to very young, and all kind of cheek by jowl with each other so that a wood thrush adult can move its, you know, because let's face it, baby birds in their first weeks out of the nest are terrible flyers. They're very weak flyers. They can't move them miles and miles. They can only move them maybe a quarter of a mile or a third of a mile at most. So we need this sort of interdigitation of these different habitat types. And so the focus now is in trying to replicate the structural complexity of those original forests while preserving the what we don't want to have are big blocks of uniform habitat. And unfortunately, across most of the East right now in particular, most of our forest is 80 to 120 years old. It's kind of middle-aged forest. It's even-aged. There's no complexity. It's not that we...
Scott, I'm going to have to cut you off because we're completely out of time.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
No, never be sorry. People need to read the book. See, that's always leave them wanting more. You really do need to read this book because there's so many other places in the world that he visits that each sort of have an example of what we need to pay attention to. My guest tonight is Scott Wiedensahl, writer, researcher, specializing in birds and bird migration. We've been talking about a dynamite new book, A World on the Wing, The Global Odyssey of Migratory Birds. When you're done with this book, you will hopefully have reverence, and this is what Scott mentions at the end of the book, for what these birds do. It is mind-blowing. Scott, thanks so much for your time.
It's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.